This home water softener business became big business, and this was where we really got our break, because we had this hardness test into a little 5D test kit. The first one, I guess, was a 5A. Do you have a picture of it, Bruce?
No, I do, but not.
But it was in a little box, and it was cheap, and we sold those like crazy. And we were in the water analysis business with that.
Tell me what the soap test looks like. How does one do that, and what was the problem with it?
All right. I'm not enough of a chemist to describe, but you made up a standard solution mm-hmm. of soap, and then in an Erlenmeyer flask, you would add maybe like a 50 milliliter sample, and then you would add soap solution by a milliliter at a time or something, and then you stopper it and you would shake. And as long as you didn't have a suds, you had to keep adding more soap.
Okay.
Of the standardized soap solution.
Right.
And you just kept doing that until you had a suds that stood. Mm-hmm. Well, you can imagine what kind of a test that was.
Yeah, there's a lot of variability.
A lot of variability.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But
salesmen were going around the country doing something like that to convince
the
housewife that they needed a water softener. And sure. This whole industry, this really was very important to the growth of Hawk, because we were the only people that had it, and hey, business was great. And we went from $5,000 in 1 year to $15,000 the next year, and we figured we were in clover.
Yeah, so... And that
year that we tripled in sales, and that was 1950. I do remember that.
And this also was now truly a titration, so it looked elegant. So suddenly you're just taking a little tiny thimble drop, you're counting the drops as the water turns from red to blue mm-hmm. with the titrant. And
with the number of drops, so tells you how many are, what's the parts per million that you had. And
mm-hmm. It's actually, these are Clifford's patents, and this first one is something different, but the second one is EDTA just over the page.
As I understand it too, the EDTA abstract
came
from a doctor, originally from a Dr. Schwarzenbach, who is a Swiss.
No, Swiss. Yeah, University of Zurich.
It's Harvey Deal and Liggett and
Deal. Oh, and Lawrence.
Liggett, yeah.
Yes, you see, that's Mary down there.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the original, as I understand it, that abstract was written by a Dr. Schwarzenbach, who was a Swiss chemist, and he just threw it into public domain. And it was actually originally published in German, and it was floating around the Iowa State.
And somebody picked it up in the German literature.
Yeah. So and then Harvey Deal reviewed it, gave it to Cliff, who began to play with it, mm-hmm. and then suddenly the endpoints were discovered. Yeah. And that's.
But this is a product that's to sell in a wholly different market from the standard.
So yeah.
Oh! When you are dealing. Oh, Arnold, when you are dealing with water softener salesmen, sir, they are below used car salesmen. They are not. Today, I think it's a pretty good industry. Right. In those days, it was so fabulous that it attracted the lowest grade of salesmen.
Yeah. So how did you actually get into that territory and deal with these people? I mean,
well, we didn't have to deal with them on an independent basis. Our largest customer was the Lindsay Company out of St. Paul, Minnesota, and that was a very reputable company. And we knew Mr. and Mrs. Lindsay and their son, and we supplied Lindsay, then we supplied Culligan. Yeah, I'm sure you recognize Culligan. Right. And I have a picture of myself with Emmett and me and Mrs. America. So we supplied Culligan, we supplied Lindsay, We supplied Sears Roebuck, and we were on our way then, and that was a very big breakthrough for us. Now, when you get into the water analysis, of course, you know, in Iowa, they've got that doggone iron in there, you know. So iron analysis became important. Well, then, from here on, it was one thing after another. And Clifford was absolutely in his glory. This was a wonderful time for him.
Yes.
It was exciting.
Yes.
Yeah. And then we were advertising, and I'm going to pause here and say, along in here, Huck obviously got people who were so much better than I was, but I started things like a mailing list and the names of the customers and got them into a mailing list in a very modest way. The cataloging of the numbers, you know, all that had to be developed because there were all these different products, and then we had lot numbers, and all of that came about. And even some of the early beginning inventory control, and again, all of this came with others who were much better at it. But this was a role that I filled at that time.
The student unknowns are not doing very well.
Yeah.
The Harvey deal has come along, and EDTA is there, but the Hark Chemical and Oxygen Company is already a concept, a name, or I mean, what?
And the oxygen's been dropped.
The oxygen initially was because of the previous experience and the hope to do something with it. Is that
right? That's right. That's right. And there wasn't. It was nothing.
Nothing. And the test for water hardness, the first thought about where to market that was to go, was it to the home water softener, or where was it to go kind of first, or was it?
Well, no, it was the salesman. The salesman of the water softener.
Yes, but it was, I mean, that's what I mean. It was the thought was to sell it to the salesman by some route.
Well, it was through the Lindsay company. We mm-hmm. didn't go to the individual
yes.
salesman.
Right.
A salesman came down to see us and said he needed this from Fort Dodge, Iowa. And he was the Lindsay salesman there. And from that, we made the contact with the company. We never really dealt with individual salesmen. We dealt with the company.
So Clifford has the realization, gee, there has to be a market for this. It's such a good test.
Yeah.
For such a needed test.
Right.
Yes.
And then it is essentially to the Lindsay Company, is that
the Lindsay Company, the Culligan Company, and now all of this was kind of developing at the same time, though, something else was going on. Clifford was sharp, you know, and he realized, hey, it isn't just the farmers that are analyzing water. The municipal water treatment plants are analyzing water. And they're still using that old soap method, you know. So that was when then we got $1.25 Rand McNally Atlas, and we took all the cities in the United States and sent a piece of advertising on the hardness test to municipal water treatment attention chief chemist, Chicago, Illinois. We didn't have any addresses, but we sent them to, I think initially we took all the cities above 60,000. And later on, we went down to 30,000. Finally, you know, we finally went down to 5,000 and started mailing out this information. And it cost $5.45. There was a quart of titrin, and there was a buffer. There was a quart of titrin and a pint of buffer and 4 ounces of the ureochrome black tea indicator. And that was $5.45.
And the direct mail.
And on the first mailing, we got a 10% response.
Which is pretty fantastic.
Yeah. We never did that well again.
So that was the entree into the drinking water.
The entree into the drinking water. And from there then, he got into the Standard Methods APHA book, American Public Health Association.
So you send out these letters, and you know, every municipality above 60,000.
Mm-hmm, initially.
Was how many? Several thousand.
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
And you get 10% orders. So suddenly from making a half dozen of these, you've got orders for several hundred.
I can remember the first day that we got 13 orders.
Mm-hmm.
And wow. You know, we, of course...
You're busy.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I was going to say, how you fill the order. I think this kind of goes back to the fact that Clifford was just so incredibly comfortable with chemistry. He loved chemistry and chemistry apparatus. So it was nothing for him to go out and buy these huge ceramic vats. Scaffolding and put the vats up on the top and start mixing chemistries and so forth. That came naturally.
So the scale up.
The scale up.
You know, from laboratory to big kettle.
That's not
trivial necessarily.
But I can see how that would really, I can almost see how that would encumber a lot of people. But in his mind, it was production chemistry and he was ready to roll. And so he'd buy these, so there would be, again, scaffolding with a whole set of ceramic vats about this big. And he started, did the multiplication and started the scale up. And
the first Fodler kettle is still at building 4, as we call it out.
Mm-hmm. Somebody who was just kind of in business to see if they could dink up something and make some money. But as I kind of sense this, this was like relish to bring in all these mixers and motors and buy raw materials but I think probably only a chemist could do that.
Bruce, if you'll remember, the first employee was Victor Giebelstein.
Yeah.
And Victor was a high school dropout or junior high dropout at the eighth grade level, was an absolute genius. And with his hands, and he did a lot of that of the grunt work of scaling up.
Mm-hmm. He was hired when?
48 or 49.
Yeah.
About 49.
Yeah, about 49.
Up till that moment, you were doing it. The two of you.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So initially, then it was just the three of us. Mm-hmm. For quite a little while.
Like how long? When did?
Well, little by little, people started being added until there'd get to be four or five of us, you know, and it was a long, slow process.
Yes, I was going to say, if we're in 1950 or 51, you're still four or five people.
Yeah, well, we only had sales in 50, we had sales of 15,000.
Which is 3 times 5,000.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the next year it was 45,000, and it was again a times three. Of course, we never had that kind of growth again. Right?
Yeah.
But there's probably a time in which really there was. I mean, this has never been done before. So again, this is the first time pre-manufactured reagents are being made in this volume. So the whole concept of manufacturing was considered extraordinarily important. Without internal manufacturing, there is no business.
That's right.
Tremendous amount of... So Clifford probably spent as much time thinking about how to manufacture this.
That's right.
As develop the product. And it was taken very seriously.
That's right.
And...
Excuse me, I'm going to...
We should maybe take a little... switch back on. And say those years around 1950, this was some pretty...
Thank you.
Maybe we should let
who contributed in the early years when I said again, everything was inexpensive, but nobody had anything in those days, you know, that everybody was struggling. And but they were good years. So, all right, now where I would like to start here is Clifford getting into standard methods.
Mm-hmm.
All right. With by this time now, Bruce has already touched on this. Clifford has already demonstrated that he has the ability to simplify analytical procedures. Well, he really got crosswise with the standard methods of the American Public Health Association, because that is put together by a bunch of college professors that run on a committee basis in classical chemistry. And so here was this guy wanting to simplify everything, and so they didn't like him. So he was not popular with the APHA. Mm-hmm. And so there was there were things said like a Hock procedure was quick and dirty, and then of course last night Pat Weiss talked on it just blew Clifford's mind that the way that they came up with the standard was to mail all these samples around and then average what everybody, and he looked at them, and you know, when you would look a graph, my word, they were all over the graph. Averaging really wasn't right. So then all of that came to Clifford developing spiking. And then that was a product then that we later sold. And so actually the animosity died off, because
explain that spiking.
Oh well, you would spike a sample with a one part per million or two parts per million, whatever, and then you would run the test before and then run the test afterward, and if you've got a two spiking, then okay, then the first analysis was right.
Right. Yes.
So that and we. That's all. That's it.
So in the standard methods, what standard methods of what? What was he kind of working on at first?
Well, that was everything for water analysis. That was everything from acidity to zinc.
But this was a gradual. I mean, this is a gradual process over time. There's a big. You stumbled into a big territory.
That's right. That's right. And we took one method at a time, and we would advertise what we. One method at a time. You know, we took alkalinity, well, of course, iron, fluoride, phosphorus, phosphate.
A big range of standard methods for different detection technologies. So this would be primarily just the adaptation of colorimetric methods to measure primarily for a specific, maybe inorganic in water. Again, when you actually make your own reagents. And I think it was the American AWWA, the American Water Works Association, just simply went to ASTM methods and said, that's the standard. So then there was a great big book on how to run a water plant, the AWWA standard methods or standard operating journal. And they just simply subscribed to standard methods. So a company pre-manufacturing a reagent really wasn't approved in the late 40s.
But we won simply because it was better chemistry, and most water treatment plants couldn't afford a genuine chemist to make up reagents like you had to do. They weren't as good, and everything was. But now we got into the prepackaging, and this came along then the development of the powder chemistry, because Clifford realized solutions just generally are not stable, and but powders are stable. And then he was also with powders, he was able to take, well, let's see, there was a phosphate test that took five solutions, and he got it all into one powder.
Yeah.
And you know, the water treatment guys just bought it. Yes. They didn't care what the AWWA said.
Help me there on the chronology a little, that the EDTA is being developed in 47,
48,
and...
Well, it really, so really took off in the
50. And that's the first thing that's really being put out there.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing that's being put out there is
iron,
what?
With 2-2 bipyridine.
Okay. And that's going to the water companies.
Well, now wait a minute. When you say the water companies, you mean the water softener people?
No, the water works.
But then water works. Well, it went to both of them.
To both of them. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the next thing that's coming out?
Chlorine.
Chlorine.
Yeah.
And so how long a time period are we in there?
Oh,
is that over a couple of years?
More than a couple of years. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right.
All of this
by 19. By 1957, Hawk was up to about 40 parameters. Because we've got some pictures of AWWA shows, and it says Hawk can test about 40 different things.
Yeah, and that was about, what, 58? 57, 58.
57, 58,
yeah. That's
so
good.
I think it takes about 70 years to get up to 40, and then those 40 parameters are in different configurations. You could take two parameters, like, say, iron and phosphate, or phosphate and hardness, and put them in different test kit configurations. And that became kind of a hallmark, was expand the parameters and then mix them based upon application requirement.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
But nobody else had
Nobody else
had 40 parameters in 1957.
No.
And this is still with solutions at this moment, is it, in 57?
No, the powders were coming along.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one of the first powders was actually Univer, which was a universal hardness indicator that was based on this iriochrome black tea, but it had, I don't know what the formula was anymore, it had stabilizers in it, Univer even had the buffer in it, so then all you had to have was a titrant and that one indicator, and even the buffer was in it. So he was good that way.
Yeah, and I think the only other company that was trying to convert a pre-manufactured reagent to a powder was actually out of England. It was Palin.
Mm-hmm.
But Palin pelletized. They took pharmaceutical equipment and put it into a little
tablet.
Tabletizing it.
Yeah.
But only Hawk, and Clifford didn't believe in that because he thought the dissolving process,
they were slow to dissolve.
You get some inherent destabilization. So ours were actually powders in a loose fill, then in its own little container.
And then, of course, from that went to the powders in individual, what we call powder pillows.
Single unit dose. So it was already pre-made.
Do we have that picture of
there's one right here in the hallway.
Yeah, yeah, so okay, a little powder pillow. Okay,
packet.
And so then we had those for just everything. And now, last year they hit 200 million of those pillows.
So that's
So
it's pre-manufactured, single unit dose. You just clip it off, drop it in a sample, bingo. That's it.
Yeah.
Now you've got 40 parameters, and you're still doing this out of a three-room building?
Oh, no. Remember last night they talked about, that R&D was in building two. And there we were still in the floodplain, and we built a building in the back that was two stories, and we called it building two. And R&D was upstairs, and then by this time, the shipping department was down there, and inventory and storage was down. And
weren't you living in one of these buildings?
Yes, we had an apartment in building two. Well, we'd had an apartment originally in building one also.
You'd moved into building one, or built out on it, or what?
I beg your pardon?
Had you moved into building one, or built out on it, or what?
Building one got expanded, and it got expanded two times?
Well, yeah, two or three. As I understand it, in the, maybe before, in the 1950s, that you would actually take the whole plant and almost discontinue work for a couple of weeks and then build a room addition. So there was a whole series of like one room being added every year through the 1950s.
And in those days you could do those things. You didn't have all these permits and everything like it is today. You could not build.
So how many of these little one room building projects took place? I think they were mostly in the from say 1950 to 1960.
Clifford used to have an expression that we had 11 built. We had 11 additions and no plan. It was a joke that he used to make. So,
And building two came when?
Yeah, what year was that?
Well, let's see. About 58.
Okay, 58.
Or 59. Uh-huh. Something like that. Yeah.
So there comes five or six little additions, and finally building two.
Yeah, and then the building two. And now we never borrowed money, and we always just saved, and whenever we had the money, then we would make another addition. So there was never any borrowing of money. Now, as I said about three or four times, this was on the floodplain. Well, we got flooded two times, and the company was growing. And it became obvious, we've got to do something. And so by this time, things are coming along. We're well over. Okay, Bruce, we hit $1 million in sales.
Thank you.
On November 11th of 1966. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, so that gives you a marker, because when we hit $1 million it may have been Armistice Day, but we worked, and I had a three-layer cake made and went up to Ames Stationers and brought a 1 and 6 zeros in black plastic and put $1 million, and we had a party before everybody went home with cake and coffee. And that was on Armistice Day of 1966.
Yes.
Okay, because we're coming up on another number and a number date here.
Okay. Can I go back in time?
Yeah.
And you've described the hiring of your first employee, who we might say was a production person.
Yeah.
When did you hire first? When was another chemist hired?
Quentin Bowers. Well, that was back, let's see, probably about 53 or 54, something like that. But we were still in the three rooms. Because I remember that Quentin was back there with Clifford in, kind of like that, I think.
Okay.
So another chemist was hired.
And what, I mean, you needed, well, you were the marketing department. I mean,
when
did you hire, when
I had,
did you get
well,
help?
I had a young lady that helped me, and, of course, little by little, you know, we're beginning to, you had to go to the bank every day, and you had to process the order. We had to make up the packing slip, and then, you know, those days we didn't have all the forms, and it wasn't like, you know, you put the carbon paper in and you made a packing slip and an invoice and all that. And so the office began to grow too.
And the sales were still, it's all direct mail.
Always direct mail.
When did you and Clifford begin to go out on visits to places, or when did you go to the trade shows?
We started. I was saying about 1954. We started going to shows.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But one.
And what happened to the children?
We had Mrs. Christian, and I'll tell a joke on Bruce now. We had Mrs.